Good evening. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut. On behalf of Torah in Motion, I want to thank our partners here at the Beit, the Morat D'Atra of Daniel Karopkin, the Shul President, and everybody on Adult Ed who helped bring this event to fruition. Many thanks. The great hope of the outreach movement was that it would turn the tide of assimilation and defection from Judaism and provide the means to lead Jews back to tradition. And it was an exciting and potentially empowering vision. So tonight we'd like to explore with you some of the results of the Kiruv Revolution. How do Balei Tshuva feel years later about their choices to become observant? Has their integration into the larger Orthodox community been a success? How do becoming observant affect their family relationships? How have their own children fared in their schooling and socialization? Is the idealism and passion that were trademarks of the movement in the 60s, 70s, and 80s still in evidence? We want to talk about the experience of coming to Torah at a later age, about how Balei Tshuva are educated and influenced and then go on to raise their own families and the complexities that are involved in that. In what ways are Balei Tshuva given an idealized picture of orthodoxy, and how does that picture reconcile with their experience? How successful are they at integrating their past and their present? And in what ways can they bring new inspiration to traditional Judaism? And finally, what's the way ahead for the Kiruv movement? So to that end, I'd like to introduce our speakers in alphabetical order. Dr. Lisa Akin received her PhD in clinical psychology from Loyola University of Chicago. She was the chief psychologist at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City, a clinical assistant professor at New York Medical College and St. John's University, and a clinical associate professor at Long Island University. She had a private psychotherapy practice in New York and then in Jerusalem after making Aliyah in 2002. Dr. Akin has authored or co-authored 11 books, including To Be a Jewish Woman, The Art of Jewish Prayer, and The Balei Tshuva Survival Guide. Rabbi Dr. Harvey Belofsky, who is on my far left here, has been the Rav of Golders Green Synagogue in London since 2003. He's also the head of modern rabbinic thought and Rosh Midrash Shah at the London School of Jewish Studies, the Rav and rabbinic consultant for University Jewish Chaplaincy. After he received his degree in mathematics from Oxford, Rabbi Belofsky learned in Gateshead Yeshiva, from where he has smicha. He obtained a PhD in hermeneutics from Birkbeck University of London. Rabbi Belofsky is the author of 3 books and regularly broadcasts live on BBC Radio. No stranger to us all, Rav Daniel Karopkin is the rabbinic leader of the Beit in Thornhill, Ontario. Rabbi Karopkin received his smicha from Ner Israel Rabbinical College in Baltimore, where he studied Jewish law, ethics, and philosophy. He received his Master of Arts degree in Medieval Jewish and Islamic Thought from UCLA's Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures, and his Master of Science degree from Johns Hopkins University School for Engineering at the Applied Physics Laboratory. He's the author of a new translation of Yehuda Levy's classic work, The Kuzari. And finally, Rabbi Shalom Schwartz was the founding director of Eishet Torah's Toronto branch from 1981 to 1991. From 1991 to 2001, he directed Eishet's Russian program in Israel and the former Soviet Union. In 2008, he launched Project Aseret, the Ten Commandments Project, which aims to establish the Ten Commandments as a central element of Israeli national identity. He also now does leadership coaching for Eish Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Shalom and his wife, Debbie, have 7 children and 11 grandchildren. And this isn't part of the official bio, but in 1982, Shalom changed my life. All right. I want to begin by asking each of you just to spend a few minutes describing the Judaism or the lack of it of your youth, and how it is that you found yourself being drawn towards observance. We'll begin with Rabbi Schwartz.
A little thrown off by that introduction, didn't expect that ending. Sweet of you, Elliot. What drew me to observance? I've never been drawn to observance. I wasn't then, and I'm not now. It's a phrase that I don't particularly identify with. My upbringing was not observant, and I still am not so drawn to observance. What drew me to the life that I've been pursuing the last 40 years was a sense of connection with the Jewish people, a deeper sense of identity, a confusion initially about what it meant to be a Jew, and ultimately finding a sense of a deeper connection personally, and of course a sense of national identification with the Jewish people's destiny, which drew me. I fell in love with Jerusalem the first time I visited Jerusalem in 1972. I was there with my family for my brother's bar mitzvah, and it was a shock to my system. I didn't anticipate it. It was something that my soul felt at home, and I had to eventually find out what that meant. In Scotland, when the 1973 Yom Kippur War broke out, I was in a place called Kyle on Skye at the northwest tip of Scotland, and a group of people looked at me because I looked upset, and they said, "Are you a Jew?" And I said, "Yes, I guess I am." And the "I guess I am" disturbed me for a number of days until I decided I had to go to Israel. And I made my way to kibbutz, and I spent 6 months on a Shomer Tzair kibbutz. And eventually, when I met Rabbi Noach Weinberg, I was able to see that what I was looking for as a Jew, not realizing that it was driving me as a Jew, was actually contained in Torah wisdom and within the destiny and the purpose of the Jewish people. So I would describe my own process as less about a seeking of religious clarity, or certainly not observance, and much more of a deep sense of identity that I wasn't aware of, but that the Jew in me was seeking clarity, and that what I was able to actually contact people who could give me an understanding of what the Jewish people's mission is, and what I as an individual Jew, what role I could play in that, and that there was a sense of individual personal destiny that was touching me, that's what drew me to it.
Unlike Rabbi Schwartz, my first 6 years of any kind of connection really with Judaism was totally about observance. I have a very unusual background. When I was in fourth grade, I had one of the two Orthodox teachers in the Conservadox day school I attended said, "There's a reason we're Jewish, and that reason is to keep the Torah." So it made sense to me. I went home, said to my mother, "I want to keep Shabbos. What am I supposed to do?" So she said, "You can't turn on lights, you can't turn off lights, you can't turn on the television, you can't drive a car." Well, I was 9 years old, I wasn't going to drive a car anyway. Basically, it was all about things you can't do, and that's what Shabbos was for me for the next 6 years. So I kept Shabbos in a vacuum. I wasn't looking for anything. If anything, I was looking to find a way out, because I felt that it was a life of responsibility, a life of obligation, and very little good happiness or joy in it. I think my mother got tired of myself and my siblings being totally bored every summer. So she said to us one summer, "Why don't you go to NCSY camp?" So I said, "What's that?" She said, "Well, there's a girl in your class who's going, and she really likes it." So I figured anything's better than a summer in Baltimore. So I went. So did my older brother and my older sister. And it was the first time in my life I saw what Judaism was supposed to look like, and it was amazing. I saw what Shabbos was supposed to look like for the first time, and it was nothing like what I had been doing. We had never had challah on Friday night. My father would make kiddush. He would drive home from work Friday night, well after Shabbos most of the time. We didn't know anything about washing hands. We didn't know anything about benching after a meal. I thought benching from the day school I attended was a fun song you sing when you're bored in the cafeteria. And for the first time, I saw people being really happy to be Jewish. So from that point on, I wanted to learn a lot more. We never learned in day school that there were commentaries on the Torah that were in any way meaningful to us. We didn't learn halacha because people there didn't keep it anyway. And so I began to learn, and I was thirsting for knowledge wherever I could find it. I would say that there's a very big break that came when I moved to Israel with my family at the age of 16. I went to the only Baal Teshuva seminary for girls in Israel that was not Chabad. And I was devastated. I said, if this is Judaism, I don't want any part of this. There were fanatic people teaching. They didn't understand Bali Teshuva at all. They were one size fits all. Everybody get out of university. Everybody get married. I said, I'm 16 years old. I'm not about to get married. And you're not going to talk me out of university. And if you think anything in university is worse than what I went through in high school, you're living in a fantasy world. So I had a very strong break with the teachers in the seminary. And in the process of their fanaticism, I became an agnostic. I went through the next 9 months trying to figure out, does God exist? If he does exist, did he give the Torah? If he gave the Torah, is it the same Judaism that we have now? And I went to rabbi after rabbi after rabbi, and nobody could give me any answers. So eventually I figured it out for myself and went back to a Judaism that was largely about doing things so that God doesn't get too angry with you and like zap you over the head. When I was 25 years old, for reasons I'm not going to go into, I heard about this Rabbi Yitzchak Kirzner, who's now a blessed memory. And I got two of his tapes, and I was blown away. And when I heard Rabbi Kirzner's ideas, I said, how come nobody knows about this? If this is Judaism, why isn't anybody teaching this? Why isn't this being spread from loudspeakers to every Jew that there is? The thing that struck me most is Rabbi Kirzner said that Judaism is about having a relationship with God. I said, what? Whoever spoke about God in day school? What does God have to do with Judaism? We even had discussions when I was at Tel Aviv University with guys that had gone to Brooklyn Talmudic Academy about whether you can be a fully Orthodox Jew and not believe in God. And of course we agreed that you could. Okay, so you miss one or two mitzvahs, big deal, you make it up in other ways. So all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, it was, now I can finally understand why people don't resent being observant. If everything's about a relationship with God, and you really feel that that's a good relationship, then all these different things are just avenues to have a relationship. And that's a wonderful thing. So in my mid-20s, I completely shifted gears. My whole view of Judaism completely changed. And I would say from there, it's been a very different story than the rest of my childhood was. I think I've said enough for now before I take up too much more time.
I'm actually thinking here how impressed I am that it was fanaticism that made you an agnostic. Because I came to agnosticism without anyone bothering me at all. Rabbi Belovsky.
Hi, good morning. As you probably already know, I'm British, and British, I am using the mic. Can you hear me? Is that better? So, as you probably know, British people are much more emotionally constipated than North Americans. And that means I'm fascinated by Dr. Akin's story. But I'm afraid that the story at this end is much less emotionally laden and also much less interesting. In the British community, there's a high degree of engagement with Jewish life, even amongst those people who would not describe as fully observant. So I come from a traditional Jewish family, which is less observant than I am, but nonetheless quite engaged in Jewish life in a way that is less common, I think, outside the UK. That's one of the great achievements of some parts of the British system. It does produce people who are kind of insipid and ignorant, but nonetheless are quite interested and involved in Jewish life to some degree. So when I was a fairly regular schoolgoer as a child, as a teenager, and then as a late teenager, became much more concerned about living a life that appeared to be consistent. This is something which no one around me had any understanding of at all. What do you want to be consistent for? Just do things that speak to you and don't bother to do other things. But I couldn't live like that, and I wasn't interested in living like that. And I'd already had relationships with various more observant families and rabbis who were, I think, living lives which were really quite attractive. And the intellectual interest and engagement came later, after having found the experiential part attractive. By the time I went to university at the age of 18, I was already much more traditionally and conventionally observant. And by the time I'd been there for a while, I recognized that if I was privileged to spend years at Oxford, becoming at least a reasonably educated Westerner, I owed it to myself to spend some time doing the same thing in a high-level Jewish learning institution. So after a summer in Israel, in, must have been in 87, I decided that when I would finish university, I would go and learn and see what happened. And so, rather unconventionally for someone from my kind of background, I decided to go to Gateshead, which is the sort of perhaps premier Litvish yeshiva in Europe, and not especially well suited to people from my kind of background. But that, we dealt with that, had various influences and people that I studied with. And then in 1990, having recently married my wife Vicky, whom I met at Oxford, and we made our way to Gateshead, and were lucky to escape by 1997. By which time I had several smichas and was on some kind of rabbinic track. And so I apologize for it being rather less interesting and exciting. But it's hard to think of any particular trigger event other than becoming an adult and trying to become an adult Jew at the same time.
Oh, sir, we don't really believe you. We'll get to it later then. Now, you and I haven't really had this conversation. It's kind of awkward. I don't really know whether you're a Baal Teshuva or not. You strike me as the best of both worlds, let's put it that way.
Oh,
but maybe you can tell. Well, I'm trying to slide out of this as gracefully as I can.
You didn't say that about
me. But maybe you can tell me something about yourself.
All right, thank you. First of all, I want to say thank you so much to Dr. Elliot Malamut and Rabbi Jay Kelman and Torah in Motion. It's always a pleasure to partner with you. I usually end up putting my foot in my mouth and getting in trouble on these panels, but you're always invited to come back.
We'll do our best to keep the pattern going.
Okay. All right, so the truth is, you know, the saying was, Halavai, I should be a Baal Teshuva, because we should all be Baal Teshuva in the sense of we're always striving to grow and do more and more tshuva, come back to God, which is what tshuva is all about. Many of you know my story. My mother fled the UK, Rabbi Belofsky, not because of you, of course, but because of her Hasidic family, particularly a certain member of her family who was Neturei Karta. She was, as you know, on the Kinder transport, so she was raised as an orphan, had to, as a teenager, live with one of her siblings who was married, and the family was still Satmar. And the straw that broke the camel's back was when her brother-in-law threw her clothes on the street because he had heard that she had shaked a man's hand on the street. So that was that for her, and she came to New York, and she met my father, who was traditional but not Orthodox. And as romances go, and I talked about this on the Shidduch panel, chaval that we don't have romances like that again today. My dad would never have made the cut on the Shidduch resume because he wasn't completely Orthodox. But my mother said, listen, if we're going to get married, we have to be completely Orthodox. We have to send our children to a Jewish day school, and our home has to be completely Shomer Shabbos and kosher. My dad, I don't know why, he must have really loved my mom, and he agreed. And from then on, the family... from before the time that I was born, I was raised in an Orthodox home. But we grew up in California. And not only did we grow up in California, but we grew up in a Hollywood industry in California. My father was and still is in the entertainment business and the music business. And so every day my dad would come home with an LP. Those of you who don't know what an LP is, it's one of those big vinyl things where music used to be recorded on, and it was the latest rock or jazz album, and so that was really part of our lives. It was, my mother had this a struggle, this tension within her about being from, but not being too from, because if you're too from, then you're a Satmar Chassid, and so you have to be from, be faithful to my parents who were killed in the war. Her father was a rabbi, but you can't be too from. And then my father just said, okay, whatever mom says. You know, that was the type of relationship and the type of upbringing. So, and I suppose, and I think we'll discover that in everyone's story who decides to make that extra step, we'll discover there are either one or more charismatic figures who bring us along on the journey. There has to be. Certainly that's my story. I had Rebbeim and one particular rabbi in particular in high school who was extremely charismatic, who was able to show me that there was perhaps more than the modern Orthodox lifestyle that I was living, which was being just Shomer Shabbos and kosher and perhaps that there was a greater sense of depth and meaning that I needed to pursue, and I could only discover that by going off to yeshiva. And that really started my career, and then I went kicking and screaming into the rabbinate, but that's eventually, the short version of the journey.
Can you just briefly tell me, like, what music you listened to as a kid? I really want to know.
My dad was vice president of ABC Records back in the day in the 70s. So for those of you who remember that label, which later sold to MCA, they had Three Dog Night, Jim Croce, Steppenwolf. You talked about Steppenwolf today.
Yes, but I talked about Steppenwolf, the book by Hermann Hesse, the German philosopher.
Yes. And thus the difference between the British rabbi and the California rabbi. Yes. So it was those kinds of bands, you know.
Okay, that's really good. I mean, actually, both Steppenwolves were an integral part of my growing up. Anyway. So I've done the box score. Rabbi Schwartz, you talked about connection to peoplehood and obviously meeting Rabbi Weinberg. And Dr. Aiken, you talked about connection with God. And, meeting Rabbi Kirzner. Rabbi Belofsky, I put question marks in both of those because you didn't say exactly what it was that compelled you. So I am interested in that. And also the figures who were influential for that. So remind me, we're going to get back to that.
I won't.
I'm wondering now, all these years later, how do you feel about those choices? Not so much would you have made become observant or connected or whatever sort of words you want to use there, but the kind of observance you took on and the kind of communities you joined. I guess another way of putting that is, what do you know now that you didn't know then? Let's begin with Dr. Aiken.
Well, the short answer to that is the book that I wrote, The Baal Teshuva Survival Guide. I think that almost everybody who became observant when I did, which was in the late 60s, was very early in the Baal Teshuva movement. We didn't have choices. We didn't know there were choices. You know, we had one person who taught us, or maybe one organization who taught us, and that's what we thought Judaism was. So if we were makariv by NCSY and they sent us to a certain yeshiva, that was Judaism for us. We didn't know that there are all kinds of flavors and all kinds of communities. And for many people, I didn't have an Orthodox community where I lived. And many places I went, there was, I would say, an Orthodox community that I could never be part of for many different reasons. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that I didn't fit into the Orthodox community. I mean, I still don't.
Can you explain why?
Well, first of all, getting a PhD in clinical psychology as a single Orthodox woman was completely verboten. It was... People try to discourage me right and left in the Orthodox community. Psychology was considered to be an evil field. You had people like Freud out there contaminating people's minds, never mind the fact that I wasn't a devotee of psychoanalysis anyway. But I basically was too smart for people, and I basically was going into a field that wasn't acceptable. And it didn't help when I became a competition disco dancer. So there were plenty of things along the way that I didn't know. You don't tell from people. They just don't take to it too kindly. So I had a lot of interests that didn't fit in with the typical Orthodox mindset. So for whatever those different interests were, competition disco dancing was clearly one of them. It made people very uncomfortable. And so I could go to a synagogue, but I wasn't part of the group. I could go to people's houses, but I wasn't part of their community. And over time, I realized that if I wanted to be part of any community, I was going to have to compartmentalize my life and only talk about certain things with certain people so that they could accept a facet of myself that they could be comfortable with.
Do you think that was a common experience of all Baalei Teshuva, or do you think that was gender-driven?
I think, first of all, most of the people were so interested in being accepted that they redefined themselves so that they could be accepted. That was the most important thing, was to be accepted. That was not the most important thing for me. I felt I had a very strong calling, both to be a psychologist and later to do Jewish outreach. And, certainly no women were writing books in those days in the Jewish world, the Orthodox Jewish world. Most of the people I knew were just looking for a place that, because their parents didn't know like, how did they become a Martian overnight? They had a lot of problems with their families of origin, their friends. Of course, they lost their friends because, you know, when you become an observant Jew, your friends look like you just fell out of outer space as well. So the most important thing, because we were all becoming observant as teenagers, was to find a place that you did belong. So I don't know too many people. Now I do. Most of the people that I know who really are going to always have a hard time fitting in are people in the performing arts. And for any woman who's in the performing arts, there's no place for her to channel that part of herself in a way that she can feel that she's at the same level that she was before she became observant. In the areas of medicine, psychology, professions, I don't think that's such a big deal today, but certainly the performing arts is still an issue.
Robert Belofsky, if you could change anything about your decisions, would there be anything, or you would follow the same path, you think?
Again, following some remarks from Dr. Akin, there were very few choices. I would gather from the time frame that I'm maybe a little younger than her. And so in the 60s, I was a baby. And so I wasn't making any informed choices of any sort. My wife would probably think I don't make any informed choices of any sort now either. But that the decisions we are talking about were made, I suppose, in the early to mid-80s. And I was in a very nurturing Orthodox community, and many in the UK are members of or part of communities which are notionally Orthodox. And that means that the framework and the people who are involved are observant in a traditional way. And there was only one way to do things. There was, if you want to become more involved, there were a certain number of families that you became friendly with, and there were people who were influential in certain ways, although despite Eliot's insistence, there isn't a single person I can think of, and nothing very exciting to say there. He's going to prod me more about that, but I'm just warning him there's nothing to say. The decision to go to Gateshead, on reflection, was a very interesting one. There was a reason I ended up in Gateshead rather than in Israel. It was partly financial, partly a function of the people that I'd become friendly with. And I have absolutely no regrets, because it provided me with learning skills, a degree of integration, which I consider would have been completely impossible in any other environment. In terms of independence, it's hard to imagine for many people, for someone from my kind of educational background, certainly Jewishly, to be sent to a Haredi yeshiva with 300 bocharim and 8 rabbis, 3 of whom are never seen. That means there's 5 rabbis for 300 people. The only people who ever interact with the rabbis are the absolutely outstanding students and the people who make trouble. The 95% of everyone else, it's sink or swim. And that's a bit of a, I don't know if the rabbi can use this phrase, a baptism of fire. But the baptism of fire enabled me to develop skills, capabilities, which would never have happened any other way. And I would do it again exactly the same tomorrow, notwithstanding all the narrowness and ideological issues that I eventually threw up. The main thing I would say is that I envisaged, as I think we both did, my wife and I, that the Gateshead piece would be the end point. That's where we would end up. That was the space. That was the comfortable place to be. And for a long time it was. Of course, it turned out to be a stepping point on a journey, an extremely greatly appreciated one. I have an enormous affection for the people, rabbis and institutions of Gateshead. But it turned out in my development to be a stepping place rather than an end point.
Why? What popped you out?
Exposure to real life. At a certain stage, it was always the intention, perhaps other than from about 10 minutes when I imagined I would just stay there forever, and it was the view of the rabbis who advised me as well that I should try and get into Rabbonus, try to lead a community, try to use my other talents to have an impact on the Jewish world. And so it was understood that at a certain stage I would leave the yeshiva environment and get a job, as people do, in a small outlying community. And it really was, we've heard the phrase Martians. When I arrived with a senior rabbi to visit this community with the possibility I might become the rabbi, I heard someone say, "The aliens have landed." And the truth is, the feeling was mutual. And it was a great relationship, but there was a lot of learning on both sides to do. And that was part of a process of I would say, reintegration to normality, which was essential to be effective and, I think, to deal with the challenges of implementing and living Judaism in a real world. A little later on, I will perhaps consider what were more sort of philosophical influences and change of direction.
It's been a long journey for you from what you were outlining before. It's more than 40 years of different kinds of changes. Looking back on it, are there places where you thought you should zig and you zagged, or went right and went left, right? Or does it all seem kind of inevitable now?
It's good. You just reframed the question. As a great believer in Hashgacha Pratis, I definitely feel a sense of bracha in my life that I've had many different opportunities to learn from different people. One of the things that happened early on that I think was useful to me, I started my journey at Or Sameach when Rabbi Weinberg was then the Rosh Hashiva at Or Sameach, and I was there during the split when he decided to leave.
What year is this?
1974.
Okay.
And there was a split, and he began Eish HaTorah. The three other directors there carried on at Or Sameach, and there was a very tense time. I had been studying for several months at that time, and all of a sudden, there's this huge machloket. There's this very great, all the Rosh Hashivas are disagreeing. Where's Judaism? And when you're 3 months into this, you don't expect to see that level of disagreement, that there needs to be a split and people are competing for students. And it was actually, looking back, a great bracha. Because, and similarly, when my mother was trying to get me to go to Yeshiva University, and I had to deal with whether, for me, I was presented with situations where I had to think through my choices very early in the process. And especially being in Israel, which I want to stress also, I think that the fact that it happened for me, the exposure, not only because it connected me to a sense of Israel and the destiny of Israel, but the opportunities in Israel are vastly different than in most communities in Chutz Laaretz. So, I went for a Shabbos to check out the Zuri Karta and Mea Sharim. I had a Shabbos with the head of the English department of the Zuri Karta there because I was curious about who they are. I spent many Shabbatot at kibbutzim and at different places that, so the opportunities in Israel to see different aspects of religious life and not religious life, but very dedicated Jewish life, made sure that it was not a sort of a socialization process for me of just finding one community and associating with it, which I feel very fortunate to have had.
I didn't know there was an English department for the Naturi Karta, actually.
Excuse me?
I didn't know there was an English department for
the
Naturi
Karta. Well, he passed away.
Oh, it was one guy. But you spent a good deal of your life really associated, until not that long ago, with one institution. And some people have reservations about the notion of just, spending your life with one institution, and feeling like that gives you a kind of monochromatic view of the world. Do you feel like, looking back, that you're happy that you maintained yourself within one context for so long, or do you feel like, looking back, maybe you would have wanted to try other things?
One of the things that I've noticed about the people who have influenced the Jewish world, and Rabbi Weinberg is one of these, He was from the Hasidic dynasty of the Slonimer Hasidim. His father was set to be the Slonimer Rebbe, but he had to escape to America, and his brother became the Slonimer Rebbe. But he was steeped in a certain Hasidic tradition, which influenced his teachings. Although he himself viewed himself as a misnaged, as someone who had rejected Hasidism, so unknowingly, I was being exposed to a Hasidic tradition in a misnaged suit, which I discovered much later when I learned the Nesivos Shalom and I had a chance to really explore Hasidut. I didn't get exposure to Hasidut, for example, in Eish HaTorah. I didn't get exposure to Rav Kook's teachings in Eish HaTorah, but not because I couldn't. I wasn't aware of them. So I felt I was. Things that I found in the last decade or so that have totally enriched my learning and my Avodas Hashem, I found connected me with my roots that I learned there, but I didn't understand them and I wasn't exposed to those texts. So in that sense, had I been exposed to them then, I think things might have been different, but I think that the foundation that I received and I think this is true of most Torah institutions, where if you get exposure to learning and you get exposure to something that touches your neshama on a deep level, then it's up to you to pursue it. You know, the world's available to any Jew to pursue it. So I took advantage of that. I sought out other places. I never felt limited by my exposure to Eishes Torah. I felt grounded in it, but never limited by it. Mm-hmm.
I just want to take off on something you're saying, and actually want to turn to you, Rabbi Belofsky, because I know that you've done a lot of work talking to people about whether the Jewish life and the Jewish thought they're exposed to is wide, is varied, or is kind of singular and monochromatic. I'm wondering whether you feel in general whether Balei Tshuva, the way they're exposed to Torah, in other words, are they given a sufficiently kind of varied exposure? Is there a very specific version of religious life that's communicated as the ideal Judaism? How do you feel about that?
It struck me for some while that it's almost inevitable that people who are attracted to inexperience, it's something which is clear, something where there's a light bulb moment, and that trying to sell a view that says, well, you could do A or B, or you could think C or D, is something which is much less likely to be something which really draws people. So in terms of the experiential level, I think that the way in which people are introduced to the Torah experience generally is very positive. They have good Shabbos experiences, although there's often a degree of deception involved in that there's a sense, you know, all you have to do is sign up to this lifestyle and you will have this wonderful family, this very, very happy experience, and you'll be affluent, happily married, satisfied with your children's schooling, and live happily ever after. Enough people are kind of nodding to suggest that they may have been exposed to something of this sort. On the other hand, if I was trying to sell something to people, I wouldn't say, well, look, I've got this guy and he's a complete crackpot and he can't get a job. And unfortunately, these people have a really bad marital strife, so I'd like to send you them to a Shabbos meal so you get some exposure to people who are religious or unhappily married. And this guy's just come out of prison. Would you like to meet them? He's religious. So I think at an experiential level, there's a certain inevitability. However, at an intellectual level, I find this conversation increasingly difficult, and Elliot and I have discussed it before, that Jewish thought, Jewish law, is an exceptionally complex, rich, and sophisticated beast. It is presented very often by people as a narrow line, and deviation from the narrow line, even a tightrope, means a fall into the abyss. Now, to be fair, the outreach to which many of us have been exposed or even been involved in is actually a wing of some parts of the Haredi world, and some of parts of the Haredi world actually think in this way. There is one way to do everything. There is a Das Torah model in which there is some great man at the top who regulates the right way to behave and think on every issue, and the outreach wing is, if you like, the kind of the missionary, I don't like to use that word, but the missionary end of this activity, and that actually is the message. And I was saying to my dinner host on Thursday evening that for me, there is an existential fight in the Jewish world, which is reflected by the Haredi world and also in the outreach world. An existential fight, it's not per se between Haredim and non-Haredim, but it is a fight between those who are willing to acknowledge that there are multiple ways of thinking, acting, and behaving within the system which are valid, which are equal paths to a relationship with God. Of course, there are things outside of it, and we'll always argue where the edges are. But the principle that there are multiple ways of thinking, there are multiple thinkers. I remember talking to a significant rabbi in Israel who's about 10 years older than me, and we had this rather amusing conversation. I asked him, how many years did it take after you left the Haredi education system to discover that neither Rav Kook nor Rav Soloveitchik were apikorsim? So he said it was about 5, and it was about the same as my experience. There are multiple ways of multiple thinking. There's an existential fight between that and a world in which it really is my way or the highway. And that my way or the highway approach pervades most of the outreach world. And one of the reasons for that is that people have a certain passion, the people that Dr. Akin described as fanatics, they have this passion to go out and as it were, and share their ideas. People with kind of live in a kind of sophisticated, complex, multi-chromatic universe are not necessarily imbued with that kind of passion. And as a result, there's an imbalance. But yes, I think that certainly when dealing with the kind of highly intelligent, the top end, let's say, of university students in the UK, and certainly with my own direct experience, Oxford and Cambridge types, of whom I know many, the monolithic approach is not just deeply intellectually flawed, deeply unsatisfactory, and actually misrepresents Judaism at a core and existential level. It actually is extremely off-putting, and as a result of attracting large numbers of people who are operated at a lower intellectual level, we risk not just losing, but absolutely rejecting and putting off people who really could be people who would change the world.
Let me just ask you one follow-up. You use the word deception. Do you think the deception is purposeful, or it's simply neglecting?
We're at a stage and where the amount of evidence psychologically and kind of and in terms of research that some of the methods that have been used in the past by outreach organizations are flawed, that it doesn't seem to be acceptable anymore to suggest that, well, the evidence, the jury is out, things like the codes and these sorts of things, there is nothing much positive one can say about them. They are may or may not still be widely used, I have no idea. But I do know that they have in the past been widely used, notwithstanding the overwhelming evidence that they are not statistically significant. There is a move in some parts of the Jewish world to determine whether or not we should use methods based on whether they work, not whether they're true, not whether they convey the Torah accurately, and not whether they are supported by appropriate psychological support to ensure that the people who get involved end up healthy, emotionally rounded, and satisfied rather than deeply unhappy and damaged at a later date. So the word deception is used cautiously. I'm not suggesting people are doing it deliberately, but it's possibly in many cases ill thought through because the consequences are very, very significant.
I'm not familiar with anything that you're talking about. I've been in the outreach field for 40 years. I'm familiar with people who are training people to do outreach who speak about these issues in completely different ways. Maybe you have, I'm sure you're drawing from some body of information, but I feel the need to say that I've never run across what you're talking about. I've never seen anybody been trained who goes into outreach to have such an approach of deception or misleading, misrepresenting Torah. It's Asur, the Oraisa. It's clear that it's against the Torah to do such a thing. So I'm surprised and shocked to hear what you're describing, and I feel the need to say that I've never seen it.
As a therapist, I'm torn by what to say. On the one hand, financially, it's been very remunerative for me that Baalei Teshuva are brought into Judaism the way they are. I think to be fair about it, a lot of what happens in the field of outreach today, and it was not like this when I was in NCSY in 1970, there's a certain lack of normalcy. I'll give you an example without naming the institution. I was asked to give a talk to a group of women who were training to do outreach about women's issues. And I was expressing to them the importance of not foisting their chumras on these women who are just coming into Yiddishkeit. And I gave a psak halacha from a very well-known, well-respected posek. And I told them what he said about a certain matter in Tarat HaMishpacha. And half of the women were practically ready to lynch me. How dare I suggest to them that they be lenient with these women who are not even observant yet about teaching certain halachot? I said, well, if you think that you know better than this posek knows, maybe you should take it up with this posek. There's a tremendous amount of discomfort by many people in the field of outreach today about letting go, letting people find their own way, exposing people to other approaches, letting people know that there are different opinions that maybe the person who's teaching does not subscribe to, but that there are other opinions out there. I can give many, many examples of, one comes to mind. I had a patient who was in a non-Hasidish Baal Teshuvah seminary, and she was very interested in exploring Hasidus, and I encouraged her to do so. They wouldn't do it in the seminary because that's not what they teach and that's not what they believe in. I've had it the other way around, that there are certain people who are told to go to certain Hasidic yeshivas or seminaries, and the person isn't comfortable with that and they want to go somewhere else, but there's so much pressure put on them, they're afraid to say, I don't want to go to your choice. So there's a lot of coercion out there, and sometimes the people themselves, you know, I remember having a conversation where I learned from a teacher, Shivim Panim Yesh LaTorah. Torah has 70 facets. And my end of the sentence is, but my way is the only right one. So I've seen over and over again that for whatever reason, people are insecure with their own lives, with their own journeys, with their own belief systems, that they've had to create airtight chumras, structures, whatever it is. It's not coming from a healthy place. It's coming from a place of, I'm afraid to make a mistake. I'm afraid God's going to get angry with me. As opposed to saying, my own spiritual growth requires me to be out of the realm of what might be questionable to a realm of what is totally okay. As opposed to, you know, I don't want to make any mistakes here because I'm afraid of getting the zap from the guy upstairs. So it's been interesting to me as a therapist that when I try to explore with Baalei Teshuva, what's your relationship with God like? So much of the time, it's a replication of what it was with the father figure. You know, the father was aloof, the father was cold, the father was mean, the father was angry, and they see God the same way. So how do you deal with a father like that? You toe the straight and narrow. So to get certain people to appreciate that we're not dealing with one-size-fits-all Judaism, that's not the original Judaism anyway. We had 12 tribes to start with. Each had their own personality, each had their own gifts, their own strengths, their own weaknesses. Let people breathe. Let people have a chance to find their own way. I don't know that that's going to be coming with many people anytime soon because of their own insecurities about what it means to be right, what it means to be doing Judaism the right way, what it means to be right in God's eyes, what it means to be right as a person who's going to be accepted in a community. One of the things I can say is that typically when I speak at different places, and I've spoken all over the world, people want to know, what institution do I affiliate with? What organization do I work for? And when I say I work for God, they get very uncomfortable. They want to be able to pigeonhole me into a place so they know, am I kosher or am I not kosher? And I think this is a very big deal for people today, that they want to know that whoever they're bringing into Yiddishkeit is going to have, quote unquote, the right hashkafas. So it takes somebody who's got a wide mind, a wide set of shoulders to be able to do this. Just want to end with one little story. The same wonderful posek who I didn't quote by name before, I once asked a Shaila Tuf on behalf of a Baal Teshuvah. This Baal Teshuvah used to go mixed swimming. He got a lot of exercise. When he became frum, he couldn't continue swimming anymore. So I said to this posek, is it true that there's no way that he can go mixed swimming? He can't see anyway. He's got terrible vision. He's going to be in the pool just doing laps. And the Rav said to me, I cannot give him a heter. So I said, so that means somebody else can. Who do I talk to? He gave me the name of another posek. So he said, if he needs to get a heter, have him call Rav so-and-so. That's somebody having big shoulders. That's somebody being able to say, you know what, there are many approaches to Torah, and if you want to come with me, go by my peace, Kehalacha. If you want to go with somebody else, there are many legitimate ways to be an observant Jew.
What do you think of that? There were a lot of things that Dr. Aiken just said, and Dr. Bolofsky and Rabbi Schwartz. I thought you were going to ask me the next question.
I am. Okay. I was just sort of struck there for a moment. I actually want to do a follow-up because I was struck by something that Rabbi Schwartz said that I want to direct to both of you, which is you talked about personal responsibility. In other words, you talked about a learning curve, and you said things are out there and people can avail themselves of those choices. So there's a little bit of a sort of philosophical tension that I'm sensing. The part of what became a bit of a party line in Baal Teshuvah literature is that we were duped. And part of me is sympathetic to that, but part of me is not sympathetic to that for the reasons that you were outlining, which is eventually the human being has to say, I mean, you have to trust your gut, and you have to say, like, I'm responsible for my choices, and I'm responsible for what I learn and where I go and what I do. So, because otherwise, you have a little bit of the rhetoric of victimization, right? I went, and I didn't know, and they told me, and I didn't realize, and that's true. But I wonder if it's true just up to a certain point, and after that, like, the individual has to decide, if you see what I'm saying.
I think that there's a process that many Balei Teshuva go through, and they feel so injured along the way that by the time they've gotten bad guidance and they've gone through ruining the relationship with their parents, whatever relationship there might have been, maybe, you know, getting rid of the old boyfriend who wasn't Jewish, getting rid of their old life, their vocation, their social circle, their support systems, and then finding that some of that didn't have to happen, finding that maybe there was another way they could have been directed, finding that maybe there was a Yiddishkeit where they could have been much happier. They're so soured on the system that they need to take a break. They need to step away from it. And for them to go out and find another journey that might lead to the same sadness, the same difficulties, is more than a lot of them are willing to deal with. So although theoretically knowledge is out there, it's not just knowledge when you become a Baal Teshuv. It's an entire change of your life. It's an entire change of your relationships. So to have to go through that all over again is not such an easy step.
You know, I got into the rabbi business by starting off in Kiruv. Karen and I started off in San Diego. We were part of a kollel that whose purpose was to do Kiruv to the community. And to bring people back through teaching them Torah. And thank God we were very successful. There are a number of people who I'm still in contact to this day who are around my age and became frum in their 20s and 30s. And look, I have to say this. There are cases like Dr. Akin is describing, and there's a lot of resentment from people who feel that they were duped or that they were only shown one way and not the other way. But as someone who's been in the Kiruv sort of mode, I'm trying to bring people closer to Yiddishkeit. You know, there is this principle of Haseila Charav, to make you for yourself a teacher. And the reason is because, especially when you're a neophyte and you're entering into Judaism with open eyes and without any knowledge, yet it's important to provide a person a very clear path and direction, and not to say, well, you know, you could try modern Orthodoxy, you can try Hasidut, you can try this, you can try that. It's too nebulous and it's too confusing. So I don't really hold it against the people who are in the Kiruv business who say, look, this is the way I do things. It works for me great. And if you'd like to try it, come to my house. You'll see what I do and so forth and so on. I think we have to sort of temper the insidiousness of what's being suggested in the Kiruv movement. My recollection of it is with very fond memories. What I lament is, in certain ways, the demise of those innocent times, both in my own personal life and in the cultural milieu, which was so conducive to people coming closer to Yiddishkeit. It wasn't that there was an intentional, there are exceptions to this, but it wasn't that there was an intentional desire to tell people you can only do this and you can't do anything else. But it was, by and large, as Rabbi Belofsky said, that the people who were in the Kiruv movement were of a certain brand of Judaism, and therefore they were trying to share what they found meaningful with other people that were with them. Of course, there are extremes. And in those extremes, if a person would say, well, what do you think about Rev Cook? And then if a person who's your mentor says, you don't want to go into Rev Cook, what do you think of Zionism? What are you saying? What do you think about Yom HaAtzmaut? It's a problem, you know, because there were non-Orthodox Jews who founded the State of Israel. And you don't give a person the fuller picture. That's where there's a certain guilt of the mentor for not having provided the larger picture. But I think by and large, I don't think we can incriminate fully the people who did those acts of Kiruv and brought people closer through their own particular brand.
I just want to say my experience in many years of Jewish education, both teaching and training teachers and watching teachers teach, is that there is a really simple thing, but it's true, which is people teach to the level of what they were taught, of what they know. So sometimes we hold people accountable for not giving us more, but they're in some ways not capable of giving us more. And I guess the key then is to be able to discern what you're not getting. But I recognize what Dr. Akin said before, that it may be so demoralizing off the top that you just don't have the energy left for more. I'm interested just in coming back to Rabbi Karapkin. What are some of the issues? I'm asking you to put on your rabbinic hat here. And I'm sure you've been involved in responding to Balei Tshuva in all sorts of ways. What are the kinds of issues that arise, especially later on? They're married now. They have families. What might be the nature of your most exemplary guidance?
Well, of course, as you know, the Balei Tshuva are not this one monolithic right. group of, you know, people who wear the same suit and the same tie and so forth. There are many, many personality types that are part of the Balei Tshuva movement. And, you know, it's interesting because I went to school with a number of people who were not from, and I'm sometimes shocked to meet up with them 20 or 30 years later and discover this guy is from and that guy's not from. What happened? Like, sometimes you can't predict. Based on a personality type. A lot of it has to do with experiences that people go through in their lives. And then, of course, there are different people are on different places in the time progression of their Balei Tshuva-ness. You have the new Balei Tshuva who's facing certain challenges, and then you have the Balei Tshuva who's 20 years into the process and is raising his own children who is having a different set of problems. One of the number one issues that I face as a rabbi of a congregation of this nature are the people who became Balei Tshuva 20 or 30 years ago and were all aglow and exuberant about their Yiddishkeit and still share much of that exuberance and excitement, but have not been able to, for whatever reason, pass it on to their children successfully or effectively. A lot of it has to do with either because they became Balei Tshuva at a critical juncture in their children's lives, so the children still remember going to McDonald's and Chuck E. Cheese's for birthday parties, and all, what they remember about becoming from was that they couldn't go to those places anymore, and they became somewhat resentful. That's one model, and that raises a number of challenges. But then there are the other challenges of even the child who was born into the Balei Tshuva family, who faces the challenge of being expected to make the same life decisions that his parents did based upon this tremendous passion and excitement that my parents had that I don't particularly share. My parents never went to school X where Rebbe so-and-so was so mean and this teacher is bad and I got bullies in my class. And so Orthodox Judaism doesn't appeal to me in the same way that it did to my parents who came to it as adults with these, you know, rose-colored glasses and so forth. And so a lot of times there's an expectation for, you know, so the father will come in and say, you know, get up for Shacharis, come on, we got to go daven, let's go to a shir, let's do this, let's do that. And the child is simply not invigorated, is not excited the way the parent is. And this creates a tremendous amount of tension and resentment. And many times we see, and we're seeing this on, unfortunately, on a wholesale level, of many, many children of Balei Tshuva who are really just checking out of the life choices that their parents had made 20 and 30 years ago. That's one kind.
So your advice to the parent in that situation would be?
My advice to the parent is step back. Advice to the parent is you have to realize your child is not you. They've had a whole different set of experiences, a completely different set of experiences, and it's not fair for you to project what you've expected of yourself and place that upon your child. And you've got to chill. You got to be, just because you were like this, really like filled with such passion about Judaism, your expectation that your child is going to have that same passion is inappropriate, and you have to realize and you have to be sensitive to the fact that he or she has to make their own life choices, and you have to be patient, and you have to step back on the accelerator a little bit, and if they want to sleep in, that's okay, they can sleep in. And so take basically the advice is be a little bit more gentle in the raising of your children with the Yiddishkeit. So I just wanted to, before I pass over, there's the other kind of Baal Tshuva that I face in this kind of congregation. And it's something that I think perhaps is, maybe I'm mentioning this for selfish reasons, but you have the Baal Tshuva who are perhaps a little bit newer in the Tshuva movement and therefore have this very black and white view of what Judaism is and is not, what it should be and what it shouldn't be. And here they see this rabbi of a modern Orthodox congregation who is engaged in a number of different activities that their mentors and their teachers have told them are completely outside the pale of our brand of Judaism. And so I sometimes find myself in the very awkward position of being rejected by congregants who know so little about what Torah and Judaism is all about because I'm not frum enough. And so this is, the truth is, and I think I've been able to come to terms with it over the years, is that I don't blame or don't have any resentment towards these people because I understand that this is really all they know about Yiddishkeit. So therefore, if they perceive that I'm a shegetz because I engage in dialogue with non-Orthodox clergy, or I'm a shegetz because I will get involved with not interfaith or other kinds of activities, or Zionism, or Rav Kook, or things that they were taught is completely heretical or treif, I have to be patient with those kinds of people. And I have to really understand that they're not coming from a bad place. They haven't gone through the evolutionary process and the maturation of realizing that there's more than just the black and white that they've been exposed to. And I really do have confidence in them that as long they will mature and they will learn on their own that the world is not black and white, but it's more gray than anything else. And that hopefully I'll be able to be there for them to pick up the pieces when they need someone who has a more nuanced approach to Judaism.
I think we had this identical moment on the panel 2 years ago where I said to you, Rabbi, you're frum enough for me. So I was just like,
thank you. I do need those affirmations. So
I'm here to provide them.
Yes, thank you.
It's what Rabbi Korobkin says reminds one of the famous quote from Mark Twain. As a kid, he said, my father was a complete idiot. And it's incredible, now I'm 20, it's amazing what my father's learned in the last few years. And we hope very much that these people will appreciate Rabbi Korobkin's extraordinary breadth, scholarship and sensitivity as they develop in their Jewish journey. I'd like to pick up on a couple of points. One is that some of the children of Baal Tshuva, where the parents have not succeeded successfully, they're not successfully transmitted their Jewish passion to their children. Many of those children are going through much the same experience as their parents did. Their parents, for whatever reason, rejected or replaced their parents' own experience, their insipid or non-existent Judaism or whatever it is, and they're going through their own revolution. We hope very much, as from Jews, that they will make the right choices, but it's very difficult to stifle the same kind of experience that we ourselves may have gone through, and we need to be cognizant of that, supportive, and hopefully find a framework in which they'll find the right place within the Jewish world. But I wholeheartedly endorse Rabbi Korobkin's suggestion that sometimes we have to step back and let them evolve in their own way, even if that's painful for the parents. I think there's another dimension, though, to the point that he made, which is that in some circles, and particularly this is relevant to people who become more observant once they're already adults at university or post-university, and certainly even more so when they already have families, is that the aspirations that are set for the ideal family are often completely unattainable. And that means we set people up for failure inadvertently. It's not at all deliberate, it's not malicious, it's not devious, but this is how it goes. Because we create a world in which the Torah scholar is the optimum person who's been capable of understanding text at a high level, the person who is, for whatever reason, capable of managing a high-level Jewish learning experience, has a large family, clearly has the means to support it, actually a sort of ideal which is probably unattainable by most people. There are, thank God, both in the always from and more recently from world families who do achieve that. But if you become more observant with very little background in your 20s and certainly in your 30s, the prospect that the parents will actually become, as it were, successful by the definition that much of the Torah world praises is quite slight. And we need to find a way of mitigating that. As I said, it's not in any way malicious or deliberate. But the result of that is parents who feel unfulfilled, who realize they haven't made it in the way they might be a successful lawyer, doctor, or engage in some other professional life. And those aspirations, inevitably, what do Jewish parents do who have unfulfilled aspirations? They dump them on their children, either deliberately or to now the child's got to be a child who never misses a minyan, because that's not what the father's able to do. He's got to be the outstanding scholar. He's got to be, as it were, the exemplar of this idealized life that they've absorbed and been taught. And we need to think about how to take the brakes off on that slightly to create models that are actually sustainable and manageable for newly religious families who can't become great scholars and never will be, so that they're able to create a kind of an emotionally healthy approach to Judaism for their children.
I think Rabbi Belofsky and Rabbi Karopkin are both speaking to an issue that I see an enormous amount of in the with the Balei Teshuva that I know and that I work with professionally. And I think there's several issues here. I don't want to say that this is only relevant to Balei Teshuva, because it certainly isn't. We see in Israel, which is where I live, that the what we call Noar B'Sikun, the kids who are off the derech, is like the biggest growth industry. And it doesn't matter if they're coming from regular Haredi families or Baal Teshuva families, it's a problem. And I think that whoever goes into Kiruv has to realize that one of the issues of helping someone to become observant is not just teaching them halacha, it's about teaching them about relationships. How do you have normal relationships? How do you have healthy relationships? How do you have healthy relationships when they're changed from what you grew up with or what you're expecting your kids to be? And I wish that everybody who's doing Kiruv, this is one of my fantasies, would be trained to help people with relationships. I know of plenty of people who had bad advice in terms of their relationships, bad advice in terms of how do you relate to other people in your family who are not yet observant. There are plenty of people out there who are doing it right, but at the same time, a lot of the people who become Baal Teshuva today are not becoming Baal Teshuva because they see the truth of Judaism and then a light bulb goes off on top of their head. They come to somebody's house for Shabbos, they see warmth, they see a family that's intact, they want it. And from there, they gravitate to becoming observant. Wanting an intact family, wanting things to be a certain way, doesn't mean you have the tools for it. And a lot of people who come into observance don't have the tools from their own families of origin to have an intact family, to have healthy relationships. And if they don't get it along the way when they become observant, if they're not going to get it from their communities, they're not likely to get it at all. And so I wish that in every community, religious from birth, not religious from birth, people would offer parenting courses. People would address the issues of changing relationships with your kids over what you were when you were younger. You know, whatever the kids are today, it was a totally different world 30 years ago. So whatever the parents who became Baal Teshuva lived through at one point in time may be completely different issues than what their kids are going through at a later point in time. I mean, we didn't have iPods. We didn't have smartphones when I was growing up. And now it's a very big issue among even, you know, FFB families about texting on Shabbos and all of these things that are big draws for kids. So I think one of the bottom lines for people that are in the Baal Teshuva community, whether you're working in outreach, you're a rabbi, you're someone in the community altogether, is to teach these people how do you raise kids, how do you raise healthy kids, how do you raise kids who aren't necessarily going to accept everything you tell them lock, stock, and barrel about religious beliefs. And I know for a fact that the most important thing in transmitting Judaism to kids is the relationship the parents have with the kids. And if the parents have to emphasize first having a good relationship, some other things become much easier. If the emphasis is on how to keep halacha, how to get to minyan, how to do this right, how to do that right, you're going to lose the kids, because what they want from parents is love, not a rabbi. So when we work with people in our communities who are becoming Baal Teshuva, sometimes just helping them find a mentor about how to raise kids in a very difficult world is going to be the best thing we can help them with.
feel there's a need for a bit of a counter voice here. I'm not sure I can provide it in the best way, but I'm going to attempt to say two things. One is that it's very interesting to analyze the people that do come closer to Judaism, how many of them actually are drawing from values that they got from their parents. My father, Alav HaShalom, was a person who had tremendous integrity, tremendously high ideals. He had no Torah knowledge, but he had tremendous Torah values. When I encountered Torah, there's no question that the resonance that I felt was because of my parents and my home upbringing. I think that's true of many of the people that I know who've come back to Torah. There's something in their upbringing, there's something in their background that was actually the key in their being drawn closer to Torah. Not because of an absence of it, but because of a strength that they were drawing from. A second aspect of this is that I've always been against Kiruv that sees itself as be like us. I don't think I would have ever come to Judaism had that been the message that I received. Because I had things that were better than what I saw in from families. Be like us is an assumption, as someone was saying earlier. The notion of Baal Tshuva being exclusively a term for someone that grew up not from, became from, is a bit of a misnomer in the first place. The word Chozer B'Tshuva, which is more used in Israel, maybe is a little better. It describes a process. It's not Baal. You've become the master of return. You're a process of return. The more common term that's used in the Dati Lomi world is to be mitchazek, to strengthen yourself in your Jewish identity. I think that's something that's more appropriate to describe. But the point is, of course, all of us have growth to do. If the positioning of Kiruv is, we have the answers, we have the truth, we have the total life that as soon as you see it, you're going to fall in love with it, anybody with his eyes open will see that's not true. So the whole notion of, we've got it all, just come into our communities, you'll see the holiness, you'll see the beautiful families, you'll see all these happy people, it's not true. So why is it set up that way in the first place? If I was not exposed to that type of approach and I would have been turned off completely, I ran into people like that, but I never had anything to do with them afterwards. The approach of bringing people closer by igniting their own desire. And here I feel that there's parenting classes are needed in the Frum community as much as they're needed in the Baal Tshuva community, I believe. So these are needs that are across the board. Our responsibility to our fellow Jew, in my view, is to find a way to spark the interest. We call it l'adliket ha'ratzon in Hebrew. I'm working in the secular school system with grade 7 kids. Obviously there, we're not making Baalei Tshuva. We're interested in sparking a relationship to God, a relationship to Torah. Actually, we don't talk about God over there. We talk about a relationship to Jewish values. Wherever the person is, you can spark in a relationship that catches their attention, that they then are motivated, and to teach them that the most important fundamental of Judaism is we're created in God's image. We have free choice. I'm not responsible for your choices. You're responsible for them. Avraham Avinu was the Ivri. He stood up against his society. That's what all Jews have to be, a sense of questioning their society. We don't buy into a society. We buy into a relationship with God, with Torah, with our own role in the destiny of the Jewish people. Not because we're buying into a particular social mode. And I think if that's the foundation of the outreach that we engage in, it doesn't matter what particular group you represent or what particular organization you're with, you put the responsibility where it should be on helping the person to make more informed choices, more choices that come from within, not by something that is imposed upon them by some socialization process. And if we do that, I think we'll find that every Jew is thankful for that, and is able to take that step of learning and following the path that they have uniquely theirs.
I think at a theoretical level, I very wholeheartedly endorse Rabbi Schwartz's observation. However, the realities are that we are bringing people into a community. There's a religious world, a framework, a school system, a marriage system, social expectations, synagogue frameworks, and so on, which have to exist. And it's almost impossible, unless you live in an island, to separate the two. A phrase that I hear more and more, and it's very upsetting, from people who became religious at anything between a year and 20 years ago is, I didn't sign up for this. And what they mean by that phrase is that they may entirely at the kind of my relationship with God level subscribe to the enthusiasm and ideals that they had when they first became religious. But they observe deficiencies in the religious world which they inevitably have to become part of for the reasons I've said, shul, community, schools, shidduchim, and so on and so forth. And they perceive sometimes correctly, sometimes perhaps less correctly, they perceive the religious world as judgmental, as unwelcoming, and as deficient in certain core areas. Particularly, there have been a number of things in the press, very unsavoury things, which have attracted media attention about covering up abuse and various other things which I'm sure are uncommon, but common enough that they attract public attention, and certainly people who find it difficult to fit in because they are unusual in what they do as a job, or the way they dress, or the way they conduct themselves. While we would still view them entirely within the Torah system, they feel very uncomfortable. And I hear many, many times, I subscribe to the beauty of Judaism and that relationship with God which I'm trying to create, but I didn't sign up for this. And it's so pervasive that there are many people who either don't join in or join up and then leave because they find what the community offers very unappealing.
I find that I'm agreeing with all of you on some level. There's definitely, it's all true. It really comes down in a way to something I suggested earlier, which is how much is personal responsibility for your choices going to be the benchmark here, even and above the disappointment that you may feel by an expectation you might have had, which may have been a naive expectation, and how responsible is a community to you. But what it makes me think about is the following. Bali Tshuva, I think, consciously or unconsciously, find themselves in a kind of decision mode about what kind of community they're going to associate with. Some of them, it seems, sort of ensconce themselves for life within Bali Tshuva communities. They go to Bali Tshuva Bate Knesiot, they kind of go to speakers who are kind of on a Bali Tshuva circuit. In other words, their solution or response to the problem you're outlining is to create a kind of subset community that they will remain ensconced in for life. Others kind of have a modus operandi where they want to actually integrate into a larger community and want to integrate their kids into it. I'm wondering if you see, and I'm sure everybody here recognizes these kinds of strategies, I'm wondering if you see pros and cons to this, whether it's better on some level to remain within a kind of Bali Tshuva subset, because maybe you'll keep getting that kind of spark. You know, I was often struck, and I'm sorry I'm going on a bit at length, but I was often struck by the fact that if you go to a shul that's a Bali Tshuva shul, the word you'll hear a lot is growth. Self-growth, growth, all sorts of growing going on. And if you go to a regular synagogue, I really never hear that word. I hear other words, this isn't to compare the two, but maybe that's a kind of enticement for Bali Tshuva to stay within that kind of ghetto, but on the other hand, I can see disadvantages.
I'm of two minds on this issue. Yeah. On the one hand, there's a whole section, a seating section in the men's section in our shul, who I affectionately know, identify as the graduates. What do I mean by that? They've graduated from their Bali Tshuva shul, that's also in Thornhill, and have graduated to the Bayit. And
that's a graduation, eh?
Well, in a sense, right. That's why I'm of two minds. Because in reality, the Bali Tshuva shul invariably is governed by the same charismatic figures who nurtured these people and made them feel loved and part of a unique community, and that understands them better. But on the other hand, it's not necessarily part of the larger Orthodox world or community that some people find themselves confined after a while in the Bali Tshuva shul, hearing the same kind of there's a certain kind of Bali Tshuva musar, if I could use that term, that many times Bali Tshuva that is find appealing, but then after a time they go through that process of maturation that I mentioned, and they say, you know what, I'm ready for something else. And so that's on the one hand. And then of course, as Tevi would say, but on the other hand, one of the things that I am not proud of, is that when you walk into a Baal Tshuva shul, you can hear a pin drop. When you walk into the Bayit Ansha this morning, you can hear everything except that pin. And the problem is that, as you pointed out, Dr. Elliott, is that there are many people, and there was recently an article in Commentary Magazine last year about this, what we call social orthodoxy. And social orthodoxy is all about the idea of being part of a religious community, an Orthodox community, but really being completely, as Dr. Akin talked about, being completely disconnected from God, being completely disconnected from spiritual or religious growth. And it takes all kinds to make up what this beautiful kehillah is the bayit. And so when you put all of those kinds of different people in a room, the socially orthodox, the FFBs, the BTs, eventually there's a buzz, because invariably you're going to have a lot of people who are not into the davening, perhaps as they should be, or as we would expect them to be or want them to be. And therefore you end up with a noisier place. And the Baalei Tshuva, who are ready to graduate to our shul, see this. And I worry about, and I'm concerned about, the fact that they may be backsliding from that really holy place that they started off with. And through that maturation process, they take a couple of steps back. So I struggle with it, and I don't know exactly what the solution is.
Before I just want to take a little survey. Do people want to ask questions from the audience, just a show of hands? Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask one last question, and then I'm going to direct people who want to ask questions that the mic is at the back, so you're going to have to stand up over their line. I want to just talk on a macro scale now with everybody here about what you see as the future of the Baal Tshuva movement. And many of us remember it at different phases. Rabbi Schwartz, you were talking about the early 70s. Dr. Akin, you were talking about the late 60s. Early 70s for Rabbi Belofsky and I think it was the early 80s, really. And we all sort of had a sense of that time of something seismic, right? The rhetoric that we would hear, certainly that we heard in yeshiva, was of very, very large claims of changing the world. Nothing short of that. We would hear very large language about a movement that was going to revolutionize Judaism and, to some extent, revolutionize the world. And I'm wondering if that idealism, that passion that were trademarks of those years has somehow come to a close in a certain way or has altered form. One doesn't have the sense of that kind of feeling now about Baalei Tshuva. And I'm wondering if you feel it fulfilled its promise. And I'm specifically thinking in relation to the reverse trend, which we're all painfully aware of because the statistics are so staggeringly consistent, which is that intermarriage and assimilation, despite all the money that's been thrown at it in the last 25 years, remains pretty stubbornly at the same level, certainly in America. And that's a very sobering fact. So when you think about Baalei Tshuva, but then you think of all the people who have kind of gone away, it makes you wonder where the movement has really fulfilled its promise or did what it claimed to be. So I'm wondering what you think the present is and what the future will be for this movement.
I'm not prescient enough to suggest what it's going to look like in the future, but I think to look at it as simply a numbers game is to miss the point. And I can tell you that the Judaism that we have in the world today is completely different than what was here in 1960 because of the Baal Teshuva movement. We had people like Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan having to make Judaism relevant to people. We have all kinds of people writing books, whether it's my books, it's other people's books. There are so many people that are out there that have had to make Judaism relevant on a scale that was stultified. As I mentioned when I first started talking today about how when I was in day school, it was all about observance or not observance, but there was no relationship with God talk. There was no idea of growth. There was no idea of anything beyond do this and do that. I'll tell you an interesting story. It actually happened at Eish HaTorah. I'm friendly with one of the people who's a lecturer there, and I ran into him one day, and I said, so what's new? So he told me a story that there was two chavrusas in Lakewood. I'll call them Chaim and Yankel. So they're learning, and Chaim says, wait a minute. He says, do you believe in this stuff? And Yankel lifts his head. He says, what? I says, "Do you believe in this stuff?" He says, what are you talking about? We've been learning together for 10 years. You know, we've been in yeshiva our whole lives. There was something, I guess they were about 30. Chaim says, "I'm not sure I believe in any of this stuff. I know we've been learning this our whole lives, but I'm not sure I believe in it. Do you?" And Uncle says, "I'm not sure. I never thought about it." So they ended up at Aish, taking essentials classes, going through the basics of Judaism. And they left after a few weeks having made a decision that, yeah, this is real. This is something that's valuable. This is something that's worth spending your life with. I think that the whole way that Judaism is forced to have changed because of the Baal Teshuva movement was phenomenal. I think it saved Judaism. The same thing that they went through in Western Europe when Rabbi Hirsch was living. I mean, it was dying, because who wanted to be like that? And I think today, from a qualitative point of view, we have made a revolution. We have changed the way people think about Judaism, the way they live Judaism, the way they conceptualize Judaism. From the point of view of numbers, are we winning against assimilation? Clearly not. I think that one of the things that's happened is the Baalei Teshuva way of thinking, of reading, of talking, of experiencing life has been much more integrated into the FFB world, whether they like it or not. It's happened. What does the future look like? Again, I have no idea what it's going to look like, but I can say that in some ways there's a bit of a backlash now. There's a bit of people wanting to be, even among the Baalei Teshuva, instead of being so open-minded, instead of being so questioning, instead of being so out there. In some circles, they're trying to put themselves back into protective structures. I think every time you go to one extreme, you go to a different extreme, and then somehow you end up in the middle. And I'm hoping that with the Baal Teshuva movement, that we're going to find ourselves in some kind of happy medium, the same way there is a Litvisha world and a Hasidic world, and now they've merged together in many ways. I'm hoping that the Baal Teshuva and the FFB worlds will take the best of both and create a new kind of Judaism.
I second everything you said. I think that's you summarized and made very, very important points. I'll approach this question from a slightly different angle. I hope I'm clear. I think that it's important to observe that the beginnings of what we're calling the Baal Teshuva movement, much of it, began in Israel. The early Baal Teshuva yeshivas were there. The force of the inspiration that came for this movement had a lot to do with Israel. The Russian Baal Teshuva movement that came about in the wake of the 67 war, for those who are not aware of that, the awakening of consciousness of Russian Jews started shortly in conjunction with the 67 war, and it could be argued that that was also a turning point for the beginning of the what we're calling the Baal Teshuva movement. Many of those who got turned on to Judaism, it happened in Israel, whether it was fellowships or whether it was all the trips of people coming to Israel. Today you have JWRP programs and many programs that are expanding. And of course, Birthright, in its own form, is an example of turning Jews on to their Jewish identity in the masses by an experience connected with being in Israel. I would like to argue that is the key to the future of awakening the Jewish people. That our mode of looking at Judaism as a religion, as Rav Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal once said, God hates religion. The Jewish people, Judaism is much more than a religion. We are people with a national mission. And that sense of connection that we have as a family and as a nation, that's been entrusted with a set of values and a religious vision for humanity, that starts with the recognition that all of us have a part in that, whatever our religious connection is and whatever our connection to orthodoxy or not. But that reaching every Jew is going to I think the approach of the early movement, which was a statement that every Jew has a role to play in the destiny of the Jewish people, and ultimately the Jewish people have a role to play for the destiny of humanity, awakening that consciousness is going to take a stretch of viewing our own Judaism as much more than a religious commitment in the communities that we're in. I won't go into my Zionist pitch, but I think for those of us that are living in Israel, we feel that sense the Almighty is calling the Jewish people back home. It's been going on for a couple of decades, but I think it's speeding up. There's an accelerated process that we're seeing now with the increase of world anti-Semitism, guised as anti-Zionism, and that we are on the precipice of a transformation of the Jewish people. But it's going to come with our own recognition that our current models of our own Jewish practice, if they don't embrace the full opportunity and challenge of the Jewish people's destiny as focused in Israel and ultimately culminating Israel, I think we'll have missed the historic opportunity that the Almighty is presenting us with. And I think part of the survival mode that we are in the diaspora generally, and in particular in the Baal Tshuva movement, is a result of this limited perception of what we are all about. We need to revive a sense of national mission, a sense of destiny, and reconnect every Jew, because every Jew is connected to that, whether they're wherever they are in the Jewish world of observance. And that message, I think, can resonate. And therefore, it's not about outreaching of observance. It's about outreaching that every Jew has a unique contribution to make to the Jewish people's destiny. Come be a part of that.
Risk of repeating some of the things that have been said already, I think that one of the interesting realities are the integration of the Baal Tshuva and the always religious world. But Dr. Akin mentioned the great publication of literature. I think that it's a very significant, much higher proportion than you would think, consumers of that literature, people who are always from rather than Baal Tshuva. I think there is a growing dependence, even in the always religious world, on the teachings, ideas, charismatic teachers, and the ability of some sorts of teachers to reach out to them in ways which are not yet fully acknowledged. And I think that I agree that the future world looks like a world with much greater integration. But the Baal Tshuva movement, as it's described, and Ari Schwartz is describing, I think, a different picture from the one that looks like now, which has a lot of kind of roots in campus and so on. I think that it's, I would say, pretty dead, actually. I think that it's dead. That the many of the people who are living in a model which was effective 10 or 15 years ago, where the people's attitudes, the susceptibility or interest, that even those who were seeking, who had, for whatever reason, spiritual or other reasons, to seek alternatives, that has changed considerably. And many people and the funders who work out what constitutes success, who measure success, have not yet bought in or understood that new reality and are currently throwing money into programs which really have no major impact. And I think that, particularly in my role of kind of advising campus rabbis, we see that the motivation, unlike I and my contemporaries as students in the 80s who were idealists and who really were not so bothered about what was going to happen afterwards, how we'd make a living. I look at the students who are my oldest children's generation, who are the same age as I was when I got into this stuff, and they're very motivated by professional success, by money, by survival, in ways which are verified certainly in London by the enormous hike in property prices and reduction in job opportunities. Those focuses, which were the focuses of my parents' generation, of making a living and really taking those things as the central of one's experience, those have reappeared in the next generation. And that has an enormous impact on people's willingness or interest to make revolution in their lives, particularly in ways like we did, which was going to have a very detrimental long-term effect on their income, earning power, and influence. And the Baal Tshuva movement needs to adapt to that reality in order to be successful. I do agree strongly, though, that it's not about numbers. That the measure of numbers, which is unfortunately inevitably, funders have to look at numbers, as how do they measure things as successful? But to create sense that there's a kind of a worldwide movement towards kind of Jewish attitudes and approaches, and there's a journey. We hope people will go along a way on this journey, but there are many people who become more involved, more Jewish, and not conventionally observant, and we need to find ways of loving them and making them feel engaged, even if they're not parts of communities. I think the future will be much more diverse, but much less intense in its outcomes.
Yes, so also I don't want to be repetitive. A few weeks ago, in a particularly weak moment of cynicism, I wrote an obituary for the Kirov movement. And it went something like this. The Kirov movement died at the age of 45. It resided in Israel in the diaspora. It died sometime around 2015. And the cause of death were changes in society and culture that the movement could not adjust to. Date of birth was around 1970 in Jerusalem. Its parents were Rav Noach Weinberg, Rav Nata Schiller, etc. And I went on and on and on. The Kirov movement died peacefully in its sleep, unaware that its death was imminent, and it becomes even more cynical as it goes on. There is definitely a sea change that has taken place. I do have a criticism of certain Baal Tshuva yeshivas, and I know of a particular instance of a person I'm very, very close with, who was always from, is a rabbi, whose son was at risk, or whatever we call that, and wanted to send his child to a Baal Tshuva yeshiva to hopefully kindle that spark. But when the person on the intake, whoever that person was, a very regrettable individual, was on the intake and discovered that the person was from, and that this person, even though he was in Klei Kodesh, even though he couldn't afford a full tuition, said to him, we're not going to give you more than a 10% discount because our yeshiva is geared towards non-frum kids who come from non-frum homes. What a tragedy. So you're telling me because my parents are Orthodox, you're not going to give me the same opportunities of getting myself ignited by your yeshiva? That's reverse discrimination. And the reality is that there are more kids that are coming from frum homes today that need their sparks ignited than you're ever going to be able to find, like Rabbi Belofsky pointed out, on the college campuses today. So any Baal Tshuva yeshiva who has not made that adjustment, I believe, is going to fade into the night or deserves to have their funding taken away simply because they're not adjusting adequately and appropriately to the facts on the ground. The other thing I wanted to say is that, yes, the current model of the Kirov movement needs to change. But there are a lot of exciting things that are taking place. Rabbi Schwartz touched on the idea, the nationalistic movement. There's a woman that many of you may know in our community. Her name is Lori Palatnik. She's part of the Aish network. And she discovered a very fascinating formula. That whereas before the Kirov movement was focused on campus kids, she says, you know what? That's not as effective anymore. You know what is effective? Look at a non-religious housewife who's raising her children, has a little bit of extra time because her husband is the primary breadwinner, and she sees that her kids are Jews for nothing. They have empty lives of going from school to soccer practice to karate and homework and their iPod and their smartphone, and then they start all over again. What am I giving to my children? So she's hit on a remarkable formula, which is, let's get the housewives who recognize that they haven't passed anything of substance, of meaning onto their children, let's bring them to Israel and give them this remarkable, invigorating spiritual experience. And it's working. She just was there with 400 ladies from across North America, a lovely contingent from our community as well. And so there are new models that are being adopted and that give us rise for optimism that ki lo yechdal evyon mikerev haaretz, there will never be a shortage of spiritually impoverished people within the Jewish community who are always in need of support, and that support should always be available to those people. But I think just to conclude, there's one seat here that should have been at this panel tonight that unfortunately the table's not big enough. I'm just saying that tongue in cheek. The one seat that should have been at the table tonight is a Lubavitcher shaliach. And the reason why is because what both Rabbi Schwartz and Rabbi Belofsky have spoken about the nationalistic movement of getting Jews to feel more Jewish without necessarily having them commit to being Orthodox. And embracing people not because of Kiruv per se, but because of Avas Yisrael, that we have to love each and every Jew? Well, what you've just described is Chabad. And I came over this, I came to this epiphany, if you'll call it, several years ago, realizing that I don't want to be a Kiruv professional. The whole phrase to me is somewhat presumptuous. And there's a story about a fellow who once went to Lubavitcher Rebbe. I wrote about it in a recent article. A fellow once came to the Lubavitcher Rebbe of blessed memory and said to him, "Rebbe, you know, I'm in Kiruv." And the Rebbe said, "What does that mean? You're in Kiruv. You make Balei Tshuva. What does that mean?" He says, "How do you know who's a Karov and who's a Rachok? How do you know who's close to God, who's far from God? How do you know who needs to do Tshuva, who doesn't need to do Tshuva? Rather, you should exercise Avas Yisrael." And I think that that model is the model that the Rebbe had the insight to all the way back in the 50s. It's the model that's worked for various communities, and it's a model that will continue to work. Now, don't get me wrong, Chabad Lubavitch has its own problems. They've run out of territories that they can give to their children. But the model in itself that Rabbi Schneerson had of just embracing every Jew purely because they're part of our people, and that if I can get you to be excited about even just one mitzvah, putting on tefillin, lighting Shabbos candles, coming to shul, do whatever it is. You don't have to be from. You don't have to be like me. You don't have to become part of an Orthodox community and pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in tuition and be disenchanted at the end of your journey. But you can just do one more mitzvah. And when you're ready for that next step of growth, I'll be here for you to help you with that next step. And of course, we all acknowledge that it would be great for everyone to be part of the Torah community and to observe as many mitzvot as possible. But we also resign ourselves to the fact that that's never going to happen. And therefore, the more that we can create avenues or portals of entry for every single Jew, ba'asher hu sham, whatever level that he or she is, the better off we'll be as a community.
So because the hour is late, I'm going to ask anybody who has a question to come up afterwards, because I think it's time to close. So you can certainly address these people up here privately. I just want to say that it seems to me that the sort of the impulse behind being a Baal Tshuva, which is not specific to being a Baal Tshuva, is really the question, is this all there is? And I think each Jew needs to ask themselves, and I think Rabbi Schwartz was sort of alluding to this, that each Jew has to ask themselves every day, is this all there is? Have I reached the peak, the level of my commitment, my passion, my thought, my desire? And I think we'll all find in ourselves that there's plenty of capacity left. I think you would all agree that we've heard four very thoughtful, very articulate and speakers here and who have said things that are very important, and I want you to give them a warm hand.